Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, March 26, 2015. Tonight, just a little bit of a follow-up from last week. I was talking about electrical conditions in the solar system regarding health. And so this is really a topic that I'm going to revisit in the future because it's such an immense topic. There are alternating types of electromagnetic effects. Let's put them that way. One being the Schumann frequency. The Earth is, as any, let's take a cloud. I talked about clouds and the fact that as the as a conductor, as a body of water droplets, this this cloud, in terms of electrical effects, acts like a solid body, and so the charge distributes itself if it's in an external magnetic field. This is something you study when say college or graduate level electrodynamics. And so the charge redistributes itself in a conductor to adjust to the external electric field, but inside the field is zero. And that's very interesting because it's the exact opposite of what modern science says, which is so typical of the fairy tale science today. And some people think, oh, this is conspiracy. Jim McCanny is talking about conspiracy. No, these are just scientists who really have, you know, they just have no idea. They studied a textbook regarding atmospheric science or meteorology or whatever, and they just have no clue. So you have thousands and thousands of scientists, tens of thousands, running around that they have simply no clue of how science works or physics. Most astronomers and space scientists stop taking physics course very early in their career. Same with meteorologists. And so how do you expect them to understand something like the something like this, just basic physics in a conductor, or something that's even a semiconductor with a let's go back to the concept of the Earth. The Earth is basically a mild conductor, and there are channels and fissures in the Earth where most of the conduction actually happens. And so when I was working, for example, with Russian scientists back in the 90s, discovering how the electrical currents from the ionosphere can pass down through, for example, a volcano with a volcanic plume, and the electric currents come down and actually can enhance the electric or the activity in the volcano, because it's like lightning just pouring and funneling down through the volcano. But what does the electricity do? It finds very narrow paths to go down into the Earth's mantle. When a hurricane was coming, I believe the name of the hurricane was Daniels, quite a few years ago now, approaching the big island of Hawaii in the Hawaiian chain. And I predicted that, and of course, according to legend there, the Polynesians say that Hawaii, the big island, has never been hit by a hurricane. And so I said, you know, that island that's growing offshore in Hawaii, it's breaking water right now, and it's off the southeast coast of the big island of Hawaii. I said, you know, that hurricane is going to short out there. And it was building up and building up, and the meteorological prediction was they were getting Hawaii ready. Everybody was bracing to be hit by a hurricane. And I watched this on the satellite and as the hurricane approached. And when it was about 90 miles away from that little island that's building off of Hawaii, the eye jumped there. I mean, it jumped, and it dissipated. And exactly just at exactly that moment, there was an earthquake, a tremendous earthquake, about a 5-point something on the Richter scale at exactly that location. So the hurricane dissipated, the hurricane that everybody thought was going to roll over the big island of Hawaii and destroy it. The hurricane dissipated. They had mild winds and a little bit of rain. But the hurricane dissipated, and there was an earthquake at exactly that moment. We've seen these in Japan, typhoons, landfall, earthquake. China, typhoon, landfall, earthquake. At exactly those locations. So what my theoretical work does is to explain this, because it shorts out, and that electrical current passes down through. Now, let me explain. The paths in the Earth for electricity to follow are very narrow. The bulk of the rock, etc., is non-conducting, so there are very narrow chasms, and the electrical current follows those. And in the case of triggering an earthquake, it's exactly what it is doing. It's possibly a piezoelectric force, or it could be an electromagnetic pulse that jars, or it could be enough concentration of electrical current where it turns water into steam, or a possible chemical change in the rock. But at any rate, that little bit of a trigger, there's such a thing as a hair trigger, and that is the case with many earthquake geological events, is that the pressure is built up. There's a lot of tension, and all it takes is some little movement, and boom, it releases that tremendous amount of stored energy. So that is exactly what happened there. And so my point in discussing this is that discussing the conductivity of the Earth. Now, there is the Schumann resonance, which is a vibratory resonance. Now, the Earth is a sphere. Let's go to harmonics, the topic of harmonics. Take a guitar string or violin string, you pluck it, and there's a series of waves that are set up. There are overtones, which are higher frequency, multiple frequencies on that string. Or take a drum head. You go boom, hit it with a drum mallet or a drum stick, and that the head of that drum is vibrating, and these vibrational modes and wave theory explain how these work. And it's based on the tension and the shape and all types of other factors. So you find musical instruments of all different shapes and sizes, and these contain resonant frequencies and give you different tones and sounds, and thus the various electrical instruments. Now, the Earth is very similar. The Earth is a sphere. It is electromagnetic, and it has resonant frequencies, and our bodies are adjusted, tuned to that. Now, when I was talking last week, for example, about going into outer space as human beings, and we would have the ability to, say, get in a space capsule, it's not enough to just build a space capsule and put some oxygen in there with the right amount of nitrogen, and, hey, you're off and running, you can go into space. No. The human body has many, 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 many finely tuned electromagnetic interactions with our environment. And so that's the part I didn't quite have time to slip into last week's show. These are very complicated topics. The fact that plants grow with electrical currents. The electrical current in the ionosphere, it's well known that mushrooms grow after a rainstorm, and of course, due to the rain, obviously, they need water to grow. They grow very quickly compared to most other plants, but also electricity. It is known that mushrooms grow because of electrical currents that occur in the ground. Let me just talk about something there. The highest percentage, the greatest cause of death amongst young American men, I believe it's in the age like to 25 to 30, is lightning bolts on the golf course. You know, not car accidents, not smoking, not the drug addiction. You would think all these other things might attribute to the greatest numbers. No. lightning bolts on the golf course because the people don't know enough to get off the golf course. Or the other thing that is very common, okay, it starts to rain, you get under a tree. The very worst place to be is under a tree with both your feet on the ground, and here's why. The lightning bolt hits the tree. The lightning goes down and it spreads out in all directions from the tree. It finds a path of least resistance, and then that lightning is a very high current, pulse of current is going out. But what happens is it comes up one leg and it goes down the other leg. And in that process crosses the heart and kills the person. And so if you're a golfer, it starts to rain or thunder, get off the golf course. Get in your car with the rubber wheels on it and start driving to the 19th hole. Don't stop, because it's very dangerous out there. There's a joke, and these guys are on a golf course, and of course one iron is the nominally the most difficult iron to hit. If you're a golfer, they're traditionally very only for the best golfers, so to speak. And so anyway, they're out on the golf course. And these guys are golfing, and all of a sudden the rainstorm comes in and it starts lightning, and one of the guys takes his one iron, he sticks it up in the air, and he's standing there out in the middle of the fairway with his one iron, with an iron handle, you know, sticking straight up in the air, and they're going, "What are you doing?" He says, "Oh, this is a one iron. Not even God can hit a one iron." That's the it's kind of a joke. But at any rate, if it's lightning and you're on a golf course, get away and do not stand under a tree. But back to the whole concept, I forget the number of lightning bolts that occur on Earth every second. It's incredible. It's an incredible number. And all of this electrical energy is coming down constantly. And that was the entire purpose of the work on the Tesla Tower. But I have a note on that on my webpage. But just to explain, the Tesla Tower is probably the most powerful device in existence for gathering energy. And there's a tremendous amount of misinformation on the internet suggesting that it be used for distribution of energy. And of course it could be, but Tesla's intent was to gather energy and then distribute it on a grid and compete against Westinghouse, and that's why Westinghouse sent out the boys and tore it down. That's another story. But also, that's a tuned oscillator. The Tesla Tower is simply a tuned oscillator interacting with the ionosphere. Yeah, so at any rate, I'm going to stop talking about that right now. I have quite a few other topics to discuss tonight, mainly the main science topic tonight. I will be talking about water planets in the solar system. And when we talk about water planets, you might think, well, Earth is the only water planet in the solar system. And that's what we were taught as kids, that Earth was the only habitable planet, which in a sense it is. Right now, Mars was a habitable planet a number of thousands of years ago, and the ancients tell us this. I keep repeating this because it's very important. NASA just did a big theft of my work, where I had been pointing out for a long time, in fact, the centerpiece of my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, is dedicated to the fact that Mars had vast oceans, and recently, and so NASA comes out with this major announcement a couple of weeks ago saying it has discovered that there was vast oceans on Mars, but of course, according to them, billions of years ago. So I'm not going to go into that, but I do want to concentrate a little bit on Mars because it was a water planet. The most interesting thing about Mars is that all of the satellites that are there now are detecting buildup of atmosphere of Mars. And probably 20 years ago, NASA sent a second satellite after a decade. The first satellite that they sent to Mars did a number of scientific missions, but also measured the extent of the Martian atmosphere. And then they were doing that because they wanted to use aerobraking to land the next Martian probe on the surface of Mars. Aerobraking is where you inflate a giant balloon, and when it comes into the atmosphere, it slows down, and the balloon falls through the atmosphere and provides a soft landing for the spacecraft. And when it gets down to the surface, it breaks open. The spacecraft is there, and voila, you have a soft landing. So the first spacecraft was designed to measure the extent of the Martian atmosphere so they could design the approach and the orbit and the path that the second satellite would follow for the aerobraking landing on Mars. So the 10 years goes by, they come with the aerobraking satellite, and the atmosphere of Mars had doubled in extent. And they were mystified. They still were able to land the device on Mars, etc. But Mars had doubled its atmosphere. Now, NASA doesn't like to talk about that because atmospheres are supposed to be there for billions of years since the beginning of the solar system, and nothing has changed since. I've talked extensively how water is constantly coming into Earth's atmosphere. It has been measured with satellites. Lou Frank of Iowa put some experiments on the polar orbiter, the UV Explorer, that was taking pictures of Earth's upper atmosphere in the ultraviolet, and they could see the water patches occurring in Earth's upper atmosphere. Of course, they tried to say, well, those must be little mini comets hitting the atmosphere, but a little mini piece of ice coming into the atmosphere wouldn't cause a large, broad area of water to appear in the upper atmosphere. And, of course, this was back in the mid-80s when the scientists were talking about this when I was visiting at the American Geophysical Union meetings. This was back in the Jacobini-Zinner days that they were still talking about the first experiments of Lou Frank being smuggled onto spacecraft that orbited Earth to prove his point. But then since that, they've been observing these, but nobody can tell you where they come from. Well, I can. These are the comet tails that attach to Earth's upper atmosphere, and they are... I have a picture in my weather book of a comet tail that's attached to Earth's upper atmosphere. It's kind of like a big, old, almost like a leech, but it's a comet tail attached to Earth's upper atmosphere, and this is where the water comes in. They attach electrically all the way down to the troposphere that drive the weather systems, and those can be coupled with low-pressure cells down in the Earth's lower atmosphere. But at any rate, the point is that Earth is constantly obtaining more and more atmosphere. Relative to the total amount of water on Earth, it's not very much. And also there's a hydrological cycle. What happens is the water cycles up and it deposits on the poles. So there's a constant movement of this water towards the poles, and that's why the poles are building up on Earth. Water on Mars is increasing in a number of thousands of years, possibly a million years, Mars will be back to a water planet. But remember, Mars lost its atmosphere to a passing comet. The ancients tell us this, that Mars was a blue planet. The large passing comet that eventually became the planet Venus, it interacted with Earth on two occasions. That's Mars. So really, in a sense, we have two water planets, Earth and Mars. Now, let me talk a little bit about Venus, because it is still an extremely hot new planet. So the volatiles, the oxygen and the hydrogen that would be water, are still in a far more volatile chemical state, in the sulfuric acid, in the hydroxyls and other chemicals in the atmosphere. And when that all cools down, eventually you will have water on Venus, but it might be, 100 million years before that happens, that cooling process. But Venus is a brand new planet in formative process. Mercury is just a little too close to the sun for water. Kind of hot and dry down there, little Mercury. But so really, in a sense, we have, if you want to talk about chemically active gas planets of the terrestrial type, in other words, they have an atmosphere, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And we typically call them the terrestrial planets. And we used to think that Earth was the only water planet. Well, no, Mars was also, and it's going to be again. We could speed that process up on Mars by using the James McCanney Plasma Discharge Comet model and by extending a tail out with possibly a very long carbon fiber, possibly a few hundred thousand miles, to initiate the comet activity at Mars. We could terraform Mars in a much shorter period of time. And I bet you out there in other solar systems where the civilizations are more advanced and they already understand the nature of the plasma discharge comet model, remember that in my book, The Diamond Principle, I talk about using the gathering ability of the discharge, the plasma discharge comet model, to draw in material for water, for carbon, for hydrogen, nitrogen, those basic elements of life, and also to make carbon fiber, to also the hydrocarbons, which would then be used to make the spacecraft and repair spacecraft, etc. All of that coming from the local environment, because the solar system is very rich in gases, in raw materials. But let's go out and talk a little bit more about the other water planets in the solar system. Now, Titan has a very interesting atmosphere, and it's not really water-based. It's methane-based, because it's any water on Titan, the big moon of Saturn, any of the water there would be frozen out, so it really wouldn't be available in the atmosphere. If you could bring that in to an orbit, say, where Earth or Mars is, somewhere in that region, the methane would burn off fairly quickly, and you'd probably end up with an atmosphere similar to Earth's in a relatively short order. But anyway, it's a chemically active atmosphere. Pluto, which they're going to visit with the, believe it's the Horizon spacecraft this summer, that is going to be very interesting because that's a world apart. I'm very anxious to see this. And even as bungled as NASA is in interpretation of data, it'll be very interesting. And now we know that there are 4 or 5 moons of Pluto. A couple of years ago, there was only one, Charon, which had been discovered, and it's quite a large moon relative to Pluto. But Pluto showing signs of an atmosphere, which it should have, it should not have by any standard explanation. So it turns out that Pluto is going to show, I predict, all of the facets of a young planet being born and generated out in the Kuiper region. And of course, what I've explained, those, they now have over 40 named planets out there and hundreds more that have been discovered that they're not talking about, some of them relatively large from what I understand from recent announcements, in fact, from astronomy professionals themselves. The recent announcement that they have discovered and they are on the verge of announcing 2 Planet X-type objects out there. And, of course, that doesn't mean they're going to come in and crash and hit Earth. The possibility of Planet X-type objects coming and hitting Earth or coming close is extremely small. And so that's a whole topic in itself. But, okay, so let's come back into the solar system. Ganymede, large moon of Jupiter, and 2 of the other moons, Europa, also expected to have large volumes of water. Io is the hot nearest moon of Jupiter, and of course it's laden with sulfur dioxide, reddish in color, highly volcanic, and certainly not a place you're going to find any water. So then Callisto also, scientists now believe that the three major moons of Jupiter, Callisto, Ganymede, and Europa, are going to be moons that have, some people even say that Ganymede might have more water on it in the form of hidden oceans under a frozen canopy of ice. It may have more water than planet Earth. Now that's a lot of water, and remember that Ganymede is much smaller than Earth. So the bulk of the constituency of that moon of Jupiter is water. So here we have now also Ceres. Remember that Ceres, they've arrived, and oh my goodness, is NASA ever being quiet and mum about that space probe, the Dawn mission, which arrived at Ceres in February, well over a month now, not a peep. Boy, are they ever sitting on something, a hot potato, and they don't want to talk about it at all. Goodness. But Ceres has abundant water from what we can determine from the smidgen, actually old data, that had been passed off by NASA. But here's the problem with all of this. If we have all of these water bodies and literally no atmosphere around them, shouldn't these be vast, raging comets? Because when we get out to a comet nucleus, there's no water on the comet nucleus at all. Yet it has a big, full, bushy comet tail, and there's no water or ice coming, any kind of water vapor coming off of the nucleus. They're measuring, the measurements they give us are from 10 to 100 kilometers away from the nucleus. So there's nothing, and let's imagine that this nucleus should look like a steam engine belching out water to fill out the tail. So the highest concentration of water should be right at the nucleus. But you look at the nucleus, and it's just sitting there, bare rock, nothing on it. There's no water, ice, there's nothing coming off of it. So how's that tail forming? Gee, I wonder if Jim McCanney's plasma discharge comet model is right. Gee, NASA. But at any rate, not to dwell on that. But the point is that if these objects, which they do, many are confirmed already, are very laden with water. Ceres, which is close to Mars, the three Jupiter moons of the Galilean moons discovered by Galileo, Ganymede, Europa, and Callisto, they should be raging big comets, and if nothing else, they should have burned off all of that water ages ago. Remember that cometary scientists say there's no problem with that water coming out from deep, because in the core of these objects, because when you get to a comet nucleus, the comet Build, comet Halley, comet 67P, the one that the Rosetta mission is at, they don't see any water on the surface, so they say, well, doggone, it's just that Temple 1 is another one. Doggone, the water's just below the surface. And it's really a moot point because there's no water coming off of the comet nucleus at all. And but anyway, they don't have a problem with telling you that the water can come up. It has the potential to come up out of the comet nucleus. But here we've got water on four major celestial objects the size of planets, and not a whisper of cometary type of water coming. The water is not leaving these things. And if you look at them, a number of weeks ago they announced that Titan had a brief moment where it went into the solar wind out in front of Saturn. And so it interacted with the solar wind, and there again, no data. I looked and looked and looked to try and find anything, any smidgen of real data information put out by NASA regarding that Titan moving out into the solar wind in front of Saturn, and nothing. Mum is the word. Those guys know that I'm on their tail. in any smidgen of information that they let out, I'm going to jump all over it. So they don't let anything out anymore. They're running scared. Those guys are running scared. And every week, more and more people listen to me on this program because I explain to you, and I don't even need NASA's data anymore, because the smidgen that they let out, I can already tell you, multiply that by 100, and I can already tell you what the data is saying, and that's why they're hiding it, because it confirms everything I say, and it denounces everything they say. Okay, so back to the water planets. We have Venus, which is a chemically active planet. It is not, has not cooled to the state to yet be a water planet. Earth, we have Mars. And then, by the way, let's talk a little bit about our moon. And you might say, well, if Earth is a water planet, how come our moon is not? And the reality is that the moon is fairly small. One of the standard physics problems that one would do, if you followed my course of training to where I've gotten today, is to determine the gravitational field that would allow a planet to hold an atmosphere at a given temperature. And let me just describe this problem a little bit, because the dynamics here, first of all, you have to consider planets with atmosphere and without an atmosphere to hold water in place. Now, that's a secondary problem. How much atmosphere does it take to hold water in place? And when you get out to the point where it has a frozen shield, Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, then that's another factor, that's another way to keep the water there from without being boiled off by the solar wind and just the heat from the sun. It's a protective layer, just like an atmosphere is. But at any rate, going back to our moon. Okay, here's the physics problem. You have a spherical celestial body. It has a certain density and a radius. That's the distance between the center point and the surface. Okay, these are the factors. Now, what is the surface gravity? You take Newton's law of gravitation, the capital G, the M, and then the divided by R squared, and you can just determine the force of gravity for an object at the surface. But what's more important is the acceleration. The acceleration of a point source or whatever, and it's the same whether you're a person or an elephant or a bowling ball or a chunk of rock. This is what Galileo proved, by the way, at the Leaning Tower of Pisa, where the scientists ignored exactly his experimental evidence and kept teaching the Aristotelian concept that the bigger ball drops faster. He proved that no matter what size the ball, they hit the ground at the same time. So another case of scientists with their smug noses up in the air, not looking at reality. And by the way, Galileo was persecuted, held under house arrest, and eventually, as an old man, he was tortured. He went blind because he was looking at sunspots through a telescope, actually caused him to go blind. So here he is, he's blind, he's an old man. They're torturing him to make him say that he agrees that the Earth is the center of the universe. It's the good old Catholic Church hard at work. Okay, so at any rate, back to our moon. The acceleration, or it's called the surface gravity, of an object. Now, as an object gets bigger, it has more mass, but also its radius increases. So it turns out that Jupiter, even though it's much, much bigger and has much more mass, does not have that much greater surface gravity than good old planet Earth here. It's a very interesting physics problem. So going back to our moon, it turns out that the surface gravity of the moon is not sufficient to hold a gaseous atmosphere, because here is what happens. if you take the statistical distribution of velocities in a heated atmosphere, the very high tail end on the statistical curve, those molecules are moving very quickly, and they're constantly leaving with more than what is known as the escape velocity. Escape velocity is the velocity that you would calculate that at the surface of the moon, in this case our moon, it would be enough velocity to tear itself free and keep going. It would overcome the force of gravity and it could go all the way to infinity. That's the textbook problem. And without and still have energy left over, so it would never come back. So on the statistical tail, the high velocity tail of the distribution of velocities in a heated atmosphere, those high end above a certain velocity, all of those molecules are constantly bleeding off the upper top of the atmosphere. As the surface gravity of the planet gets greater and greater and greater, such as with Earth, it's enough to hold the atmosphere indefinitely. And so that's the state we're at. If you heated Earth's atmosphere up to, let's say, another 50 degrees, it would start to bleed off more atmosphere and eventually could potentially lose it. So there's a number of factors. What's the surface gravity of the celestial object? What is the temperature of the object, of the atmosphere, etc., and how much contributing factors from, like, say, solar wind or heat from the sun, all of these factors contribute. It can be a fairly complicated problem once you include all of the factors. But, okay, the bottom line is our moon, which is a good-sized celestial object, it is simply not large enough to support a gaseous atmosphere given our distance from the sun and the temperature. So the moon is not going to be a water planet, and it does have a faint atmosphere actually of sodium, which is very interesting. It has a tail, a comet tail of sodium, which has been discovered, and the scientists can't tell you why that's there. Well, why should the moon have this nice little cloud of sodium around it? Well, sodium is heavier. It's an element that comes in actually from Jupiter, so from passing comets, etc., that carry this in around into the region around Earth. The moon has picked up some sodium, and it maintains it in the form of a comet tail. Mainly, our moon is out in the solar wind. It acts like a comet. It's electrically charged. It's a contributor to our electric and our magnetic field, because it's moving in a circular orbit around Earth, and so there's other factors dealing with the moon, but it's not a water planet. Okay, now I'm going to step into a new phase in this discussion. Given that these icy objects should be raging comets, according to the Dirty Snowball Comet model, and they're not, and, of course, the standard science would say, well, they're too far away from the sun. The biggest comets in history were discovered beyond the orbit of Saturn. And so, once again, standard science can't explain it because there's not enough sunlight or solar wind in those locations. So they just kind of pretend that those things didn't happen. And they invent a region outside of the orbit of Mars, and they call it the Christmas Zone. Isn't that a sweet name? The Christmas Zone by NASA. And it talks about the fact that inside those, their belief that inside that zone, comets form and start to sublimate water off the nucleus. And outside that zone, they really aren't very active. And that's how they make an excuse for the fact that these major celestial objects, Ceres and the three icy moons of Jupiter, don't have any a comet activity. But let's look at the plasma discharge comet model, which is the correct model. That would tell you that Ceres, Mars, the three icy moons of Jupiter, Earth, Venus, all are having involved in ongoing discharge of the solar capacitor. and all are involved in acquiring more material. Water, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, the other sulfur if you're out by Jupiter. And so these are the building blocks. Now, it's very interesting because the three big moons of Jupiter lie outside the region where Jupiter harbors a tremendous amount of sulfur. It turns out the majority of that is in a comet tail, which has its nucleus is the moon Io of Jupiter. Now, there's a sulfur ring, a sulfur dioxide ring, and so standard astronomy says, oh, that's being sputtered off of Io. Well, if that were being sputtered off of Io, it wouldn't be there after 4.5 billion years. It would be all sputtered away. And so these are calculations that somebody can easily make. NASA scientists should have done it. And, of course, like every Band-Aid they have, it doesn't add up. But the reality is that these moons are, they're either like Io is in the proton wind supported of the proton wind supported capacitor of Jupiter and is acting as a comet in that zone of Jupiter. So at any rate, I'm going to switch gears a couple times here. First of all, I'm going to talk to kids, because hopefully if I have my way, we are going to have a space program for people someday, and kids will be able to go out and explore and study these areas. Unfortunately, our space program today, the constituency of NASA is Tier 2 baloney science, and unfortunately, it's very locked down. It's almost impossible to get a job in NASA, and if you did, you would be sequestered and really wouldn't have any freedom to investigate. And it appears that way that they do, but the reality is that no, they really don't. The real research goes on in what I call Tier 1 layer, and those people are bought and paid for, owned, lock, stock, and barrel to the point of death at some kind of gunpoint to not divulge anything that they do. So it's not really a fun place to be, let's put it that way. And so the people that are, a lot of people get into science, they get into Tier 1, and then they really don't have any way out. I've met a lot of people that are in Tier 1, and they seem to be relatively happy. They, of course, do top-level science, but it's not the life for me, believe me, to being completely owned. And a lot of these people believe that they are doing this to defend their country, when in reality they are working for the world bankers who control all of this, and all the science they do, all of the good that they do, really goes for a lot of evil in the world. Look at all the weapons development, all of the new technologies. The first thing that happens to a new technology when somebody devises something or creates something, the very first thing that happens to it is it becomes a weapon. And this has been going on since the first improvement in metals from the from the primitive days of cavemen. A better rock to throw, you know, a sling to throw a rock with, whatever it was an improvement. The first thing it was used for was military. Somehow, this planet has to get away from this, because literally we have used up all of the planet's resources, much of them going down a black hole into the military. So what I am trying to do, and there are some other people out there trying to build a private space program, let me just mention, in the course that I'm releasing right now that's out there running, and people have been purchasing it, it's not for everybody because it's very intensive, but I suggest that schools, especially homeschools, get a copy of this in something that the kids are going to get their teeth into, real science. And there's a lot of unknowns in science. This is what I'm telling kids today. There are many, many, many unknowns. There's a lot of research that has to be done. And the human race has a long way to go. Don't ever think for a second that everything is known and understood. The science that's presented today, the Big Bang, is just it's like when we were in college, every Tuesday we had meat, and we called it mystery meat because nobody could figure out what it was. Well, that's the state of cosmology today. It's mystery science. Nobody can figure out, not even the people who are involved in it. So there's a rich awakening for kids. And so that's why, for example, with the course that I'm offering, the DVD number 4, schools can buy a copy and then show it to classrooms, etc. And so I'm trying to make it as economically feasible for schools. The only thing I ask is you don't copy it and send it to other schools, or just copy it and send it home with people for individual use, that the schools use it as an educational device, and they can, with K-12 only, they can use it for multiple students. But I really want to encourage kids, and if your kids in high school or in college even, study basic science, mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, because in those levels there's a lot of very good, well-defined science. Take as much mathematics as you can. That's my advice. I did. When I was in college, I had a double major in mathematics and physics, and that did a lot of good for me. When I eventually got my master's degree and then I was out in the world teaching, I taught mathematics. I probably taught every course in mathematics at the university level. It's in my bio. You can go read it there. But mathematics also teaches you how to think, and take as much mathematics as you can. One of the biggest problems today with scientists, as I say, astronomy, space science, is that they stopped taking physics courses way too early in their career. And as a result, they cannot analyze problems. They can't. They cannot pick apart the baloney that they're being taught in textbooks. They read it, they regurgitate it, they get their A, and they go on to get a job someplace. There's a tremendous problem in the sciences today, and I see this all the time. Simple things, like I was talking earlier in the show. The fact that a cloud, because it's a conductor, it's in an external electric field, and because the charge distributes around the outside edge of that, like a conductor, that the electric field to the inside should be very small. And, of course, you can measure electric fields because they're actually changing in there, and it's a dynamic system. There's air currents, etc. But the standard story that somehow tumultuous activity within a cloud of wind currents somehow creates the electric fields that create the lightning that comes shooting out the bottom and the top of the cloud is just very bad science. It's simply not, it just couldn't possibly be true if you understand basic physics. But what I'm saying is that the majority of space scientists, meteorologists, planetary geologists, etc., they don't know physics. They don't understand, like on the surface of a comet, for example. You know, given a temperature of 76 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty warm in outer space, things are supposed to be very cold, and given the fact that there's no surface pressure, because there's no atmosphere, that even if the water vapor, or even if it's contained down deep in this, allegedly contained down deep in the this dust and sand and snowball, that there's not enough vapor pressure at that temperature to hold it, and it would go almost instantly. You'd see the water vapor just fly out of there, and you wouldn't need solar heating at all. So you're dealing with scientists. They don't understand chemistry. They don't understand physics. They have very poor mathematics backgrounds. And they've read a theory in a textbook, and they'll carry that to their grave because they got an A in it in college or in graduate school. That's what's going on today. And that's why when a lot of data comes in from outer space, scientists are surprised, and they don't know what to do with it. So somebody comes along, throws out some hip pocket theory, and that sticks like mud on a wall, and life goes back to normal. Nobody has to think about that anymore because Joe over there threw some mud on the wall, got a Band-Aid on that one. Okay, now you can go on. That's what's been happening in the sciences. So now, imagine having to go up like I've had to do through my career and talk to these people. Say I'm at a Los Alamos National Laboratories giving a talk, or say I'm at the International Propulsion System Conference talks, and or say I'm at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and people are coming up talking to me, and I realize these people don't know anything. They have very poor backgrounds, and you describe a concept like, let's take an example. How does a Van de Graaff bell, this is a hollow shell of metal, you have a rubber band going up through the middle carrying charge up, and it continues to charge up and get higher and higher electrical potential, and you can continue putting charge on this until it starts to bleed off the surface. And so how can you keep putting charge on something that doesn't that is already highly charged? Well, the fact is you're putting it in the inside. If you had to bring that charge from the outside and put it on that bell, it'd be very difficult. But you're bringing it up through the inside, and that charge just flies out there. It wants to get out there because it's moving away from all the other charges. It's trying its hardest. These are free electrons collecting on the bell. It's negatively charged. Those electrons are trying their hardest to get out to the surface of that metal sphere and stay there. They want to get as far away from the electrons coming up on the center belt as they can. But people don't understand in terms of physical principles how these things work. And that's the problem. Now, imagine the solar wind, which is acting very similarly. You have an excess current of protons in the solar wind, and they can't understand how those protons keep moving out. What's the force that makes all those protons want to get out there to that nebular ion cloud at the edge of the universe, the edge of the solar system? What makes those protons want to get out there and leave the negatively charged sun? Well, first of all, the negatively charged sun is shielded by the time you get out to that point. But the protons are acting just like the current in the Van de Graaff generator. But hey, you're dealing with people that don't understand science at all. And so they can't imagine certain things. You find them doing calculations and you see this puzzled look on their face. So things that are very basic physics totally escape them. So when I present my models for various things, I mean, you can have experimental evidence, you can show them. They say, well, we have a spacecraft that measures electrons and protons, and they're always the same numbers. Well, that's right, because if there were an excess of one of them, that spacecraft would charge up to that potential, and now you're going to have equal numbers of both of them. So the morons at NASA, when I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show debating Dr. David Morrison, top NASA scientist, that point came up. And he said, we've measured the solar wind. It's neutral. There are always even numbers of protons and electrons. So here you got a guy, top scientist at NASA, PhD, student of Carl Sagan, doesn't know basic physics, electromagnetic theory. How can a spacecraft charge up and then prevent the opposite size charge from coming in greater numbers? Well, if it's coming in greater numbers, guess what? That spacecraft is going to build up until it reaches a certain potential, and then you're going to have equal numbers of protons because there's no ground that spacecraft doesn't have a ground wire. Simple physics, and they don't understand it. So how do you talk? How do you approach people who have control over satellite development when they don't know understand basic physics? The vast majority of satellites in NASA's fleet are incorrectly designed. How can you understand electric fields when you don't understand what an electric field is? So they talk about magnetic fields. Magnetic fields are secondary effects. They don't understand that there's something fundamental that's going on that causes those magnetic fields. The magnetic field of Earth, if you stopped all the electrical currents that are flowing around because of the solar capacitor, which is driving all of this, hey, what's driving the solar capacitor? Well, it's the fusion engine that's burning in the surface of the sun, not at the core, because you wouldn't have any solar wind if the fusion were at the core of the sun. Basic. How do the protons get up to the surface of the sun through all of that atmosphere and come shooting out if the fusion is at the core? It doesn't work. These people are just, there's so many incorrect theories that are floating around in the space science world today. It's just lollipops and roses because they can publish. So anyway, this is. Let me go back to kids. Kids, you got to study physics. And this is why also I'm putting out my coursework, so that kids and adults and anybody out there, scientists, there's a lot of scientists that are looking at this course and understanding the true workings of the cosmos. And the first course starts out with cosmology, the big picture, galaxies, electrical currents in large-scale cosmology, etc. You can read the outline. I'm not going to go through that outline on my radio show, but go to the webpage jmccsci.com. And there is such a vast amount of material that I have to present here. It's going to take 16 7-hour DVDs to get through the bulk of it. And you could probably take any one or two sentences in these, and I could expand on that for another, just that one sentence, for maybe another 3 hours. So it's very important to get this information out to the public. And once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and look at the information. This new course is fundamental. Starts at the big picture, and then it'll work down to the other topics. But remember that even in the big picture of cosmology, the topic of Planet X, the many Planet X objects, shows its ugly head, and it comes right out of galactic development. I mean, so you have to start there to understand solar system development and comets and everything else that comes later. And what you'll find is I've developed a completely self-consistent theory from top to bottom, wall to wall, from beginning to end. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.